more like the difference in air pressure at the point where the material and the immaterial meet. He sat for a long time at the bottom of that void, leaning against the wall, smoking tasteless cigarettes. When that girl left, she left behind this void. No, maybe not. Maybe she just showed me something that was already there, inside me. Ushikawa knew that Eriko Fukada had literally shaken him to his core. Her unwavering, pointed gaze shook him not only physically but to the center of his being, like someone who had fallen passionately in love. He had never felt this way before in his life. No, that can't be right, he thought. Why should I be in love with that girl? We have to be the most ill-matched pair one could possibly imagine. He didn't need to check himself out in the mirror to confirm this, but it wasn't just about looks. In every possible aspect, he decided, no one is further removed from her than me. Sexually, he wasn't attracted to her. As far as sexual desire was concerned, a couple of times a month Ushikawa called a prostitute he knew, and that was enough. Call her up, have her over to a hotel room, and have sex, like going to the barber. It had to be something on a more spiritual level, Ushikawa concluded. It was hard to accept, but Ushikawa and that lovely girl had, while staring at each other through opposite ends of the camouflage telephoto lens, reached a kind of understanding that emanated from the deepest, darkest recesses of their beings. It had happened in an instant, yet they had laid bare their very souls. And then she had gone off, leaving Ushikawa behind, alone in this void. The girl knew I was secretly observing her through this telephoto lens, and she must have known, too, that I followed her to the supermarket near the station. She never looked back even once then, but she definitely knew I was there. But he hadn't seen any criticism in her eyes. Ushikawa felt that somehow, in some far-off, deep place, she had understood him. The girl had shown up, then left. We came from different directions. Our paths happened to cross. Our eyes met for an instant. Then we moved off in different directions once more. I probably won't run across Eriko Fukada again. Leaning against the wall, Ushikawa looked through the gap in the curtain and watched people coming and going. Maybe Fuka Eri would come back. Maybe she would remember something important she had left back in the apartment. But she didn't. She had made up her mind to move on to somewhere else, and she would never return. Ushikawa spent the afternoon feeling deeply powerless. The sense of impotence was formless, weightless. His blood moved slowly, sluggishly through his veins. It was as if his vision were covered by a fine mist, while the joints in his arms and legs felt creaky and dull. When he shut his eyes, the ache of her gaze stabbed at his ribs, the ache rolling in and out like gentle waves at the shore, rolling in again, then receding. Sometimes the pain was so great it made him wince. At the same time, though, Ushikawa realized it gave him a warm feeling, like nothing he had ever experienced. His wife and two daughters, his snug little house with a lawn in Churinkan, they had never made him feel this warm. He had always had something like a clod of frozen dirt stuck in his heart, a hard, cold core he had always lived with. He had never felt it as cold. For him, it was the normal temperature. Even so, Fuka Eri's gaze had, if even for a moment, melted that icy core, and it brought on the dull ache. The warmth and the pain came as a pair. And unless he accepted the pain, he couldn't feel the warmth. It was a kind of trade-off. In a little sunny spot, Ushikawa experienced the pain and the warmth simultaneously, quietly, without moving a muscle. It was a calm, peaceful winter's day. People on the street passed through the delicate sunshine as they strolled by. But the sun was steadily moving west, hidden in the shadow of the building, and the little pool of sunlight he was in soon disappeared. The warmth of the afternoon was gone, and the cold of the night was gathering around him. Ushikawa sighed deeply, and reluctantly peeled himself away from the wall. His body still had a lingering numbness, but not enough to stop him from moving about the room. He finally rose to his feet, stretched his limbs, and moved his short, thick neck around to work out the kinks. He balled his fists, then stretched out his fingers again and again. Then he got down on the tatami and did his usual stretching exercises. All his joints cracked dully, and his muscles slowly regained their normal suppleness. It was now the time of day when people came back from work and school. "I need to continue to keep a watch over them," he told himself. "This isn't a question of whether I want to or not, or whether it's the right thing to do. Once I start something, I have to see it through." Ushikawa sat down again behind the camera. It was completely dark outside now, and the light at the entrance had come on. "It must be on a timer," he thought. Like nameless birds returning to their shabby nests, people stepped into the entrance. Tango Kawana wasn't among them, but Ushikawa figured he would be back before long. He couldn't take care of his sick father forever. Most likely, he would be back in Tokyo before the new week started, so he could return to work. Within a few days, or maybe even today or tomorrow. "I may well be just a cheerless, grubby little creature. A bug on the damp underside of a rock. So be it. I'll be the first to admit it. But I'm a relentlessly capable, patient, tenacious bug. I don't give up easily. Once I get a hold of a clue, I pursue it to the bitter end. I'll climb up the highest wall you've got. I have to get back that cold core inside me. Right now, that's exactly what I need." Ushikawa rubbed his hands together in front of the camera and checked to make sure all 10 fingers were working properly. "There are lots of things ordinary people can do that I can't, that's for sure. Playing tennis, skiing, for instance, working in a company, having a happy family. On the other hand, there are a few things I can do that most other people can't, and I do these few things very, very well. I'm not expecting applause or for people to shower me with coins, but I do need to show the world what I'm capable of." At 9:30, Ushikawa ended his surveillance for the day. He heated a can of chicken soup over a portable stove and carefully sipped it with a spoon. He ate 2 cold rolls, then polished off an apple, peel and all. He peed, brushed his teeth, spread out his sleeping bag, stripped down to his underwear, and snuggled inside. He zipped the bag up to his neck and curled up like a bug. And thus, Ushikawa's day was over. It hadn't been a very productive day. All he had been able to do was watch Fuka Eri exit the building with all her belongings. He didn't know where she had gone. Somewhere, but where? Inside the sleeping bag, he shook his head. Wherever she went, it didn't concern him. After a time, his frozen body warmed up, his mind faded, and he fell into a deep sleep. Once more, the tiny frozen core occupied a solid place in his soul. Nothing much happened the next day. 2 days later was Saturday, another warm, peaceful day. Most people slept in during the morning. Ushikawa, though, sat by the window listening to a tiny radio, the news, traffic updates, the weather report. Just before 10, a large crow flew up and stood at the empty front steps of the building. The crow looked around meticulously, moving its head a few times like it was nodding. It bobbed its thick, large beak up and down, its brilliant black feathers glistening in the sunlight. The mailman pulled up in his small red motorcycle, and the crow reluctantly spread its wings wide and flew off. As it flew away, it squawked once. After the mailman had sorted all the mail into the mailboxes and left, a flock of sparrows twittered over. They bustled around the entrance, but found nothing worthwhile, and flew away. Next, it was a striped cat's turn. He had on a flea collar and probably belonged to a neighbor. Ushikawa had never seen the cat before. The cat peed in a dried-up flower bed, sniffed the result, and, apparently displeased with what it found, twitched its whiskers as if it were bored. Tail up, it disappeared behind the building. In the morning, several residents exited the building. From the way they were dressed, it looked like they were going out for a relaxed day or going shopping in the neighborhood, one or the other. Ushikawa knew almost all their faces by now, but he had not a speck of interest in their personalities or private lives. He never even tried to imagine them. "Your own lives are surely very important to each one of you. Very precious to you, I get it. But to me, they don't matter one way or the other. To me, you're just flimsy paper dolls walking across a stage. There's only one thing I'm asking of all of you. Remain paper dolls, and don't interfere with my job here. Isn't that right, Mrs. Pear?" He had given the woman currently passing this nickname because she was pear-shaped with a huge rear end. "You're just a cut-out paper doll. You're not real. Do you realize that? Though you are a bit on the chunky side for a paper doll." As he thought this, though, everything in the scene before him began to seem meaningless, to not matter one way or the other. Maybe the scene in front of him didn't exist in the first place. Maybe he was the one being deceived by cut-out people who didn't really exist. Ushikawa grew uneasy. Being locked up in this empty apartment day after day, spying on people, must be getting to him. Something that would definitely get on a person's nerves. He decided to verbalize his thoughts to pull himself out of this funk. "Good morning there, long ears," he said, looking through the viewfinder and addressing a tall, thin old man. The tips of the old man's ears stuck out like horns from beneath his white hair. "Out for a walk? Walking's good for you. It's nice out today, so have a good time. I would love to take a walk and stretch my limbs a bit, but I'm stuck here, keeping watch over this crummy entrance day after day." The old man had on a cardigan and wool trousers and had excellent posture. He would look perfect taking a faithful white dog out for a walk, but pets weren't allowed in the building. Once the old man was gone, Ushikawa was suddenly struck by a sense of impotence. "This surveillance is going to end up being a waste of time," he decided. "My intuition is worthless, and all the hours I've spent in this vacant room are leading me exactly nowhere. All I have to show for it is a set of frayed nerves, worn away like the bald head of a Jizo statue that passing children rub for good luck." After 12, Ushikawa ate an apple and some cheese and crackers, and a rice ball with pickled plum inside. He then leaned back against the wall and fell asleep. It was a short, dreamless sleep, yet when he awoke, he couldn't remember where he was. His memory was a perfectly square, perfectly empty box. The only thing in the box was empty space. Ushikawa gazed around the space. He found it wasn't just a void, but a dim room, empty, cold, without a stick of furniture. He didn't recognize the place. There was an apple core on an unfolded newspaper next to him. Ushikawa felt confused. "Why am I in such a weird place?" Finally, it came to him, and he remembered what he had been doing. Staking out the entrance to Tango's apartment. "That's right. That's why I have this single-lens reflex Minolta with a telephoto lens." He remembered the old man with white hair and long ears out for a walk alone. Like birds flying home to their nests at twilight, memories gradually returned to the empty box, and two solid facts emerged. One, Eriko Fukada has left. Two, Tengo Kawana hasn't come back yet. No one was in Tengo Kawana's third-floor apartment. The curtains were drawn, and silence enveloped the deserted place. Other than the compressor of the fridge switching on from time to time, nothing disturbed the silence. Ushikawa let his imagination wander over the scene. Imagining a deserted room was a lot like imagining the world after death. Suddenly he remembered the NHK fee collector and his obsessive knocking. He had kept constant watch, but never saw any trace that this mysterious man had left the building. Could he be a resident here? Or was it someone who lived here, who liked to pretend to be a fee collector to harass the other residents? If the latter, what would possibly be the point? This was a very morbid theory, but what else could explain such a strange situation? Ushikawa had no idea. Tengo Kuwana showed up at the entrance to the apartment building just before 4 that afternoon. He wore an old windbreaker with the collar turned up, a navy blue baseball cap, and a travel bag slung over his shoulder. He didn't pause at the entrance, didn't glance around, and went straight inside. Ushikawa's mind was still a bit foggy, but he couldn't miss that large figure. "Welcome back, Mr. Kuwana," Ushikawa muttered aloud, and snapped 3 photos with the motor drive camera. "How's your father doing? You must be exhausted. Please rest up. Nice to come home, isn't it? Even to a miserable place like this. By the way, Eriko Fukada moved out with all her belongings while you were gone." But his voice didn't reach Tengo. He was just muttering to himself. Ushikawa glanced at his watch and wrote a memo in his notebook. 3:56 p.m., Tengo Kuwana back home from trip. At the same moment that Tengo appeared at the entrance, a door somewhere opened wide, and Ushikawa felt reality returning. Like air rushing into a vacuum, his nerves were instantly sharp, his body filled with a fresh vitality. He was again a useful part of the outside world. There was a satisfying click as things fell into place. His circulation sped up, and just the right amount of adrenaline surged through his body. "Good. This is how it should be. This is the way I'm supposed to be, the way the world is supposed to be." It was after 7 p.m. when Tengo appeared at the entrance again. The wind had picked up after sunset, and the temperature had dropped. Tengo wore a sweater under a windbreaker with faded jeans. He stepped outside and stood there looking around, but he didn't see anything. He glanced at where Ushikawa was hiding, but didn't pick out the observer. "He's different from Eriko Fukada," Ushikawa thought. "She's special. She can see what others can't. But you, Tengo, for better or worse, you're an ordinary person. You can't see me sitting here." Seeing that nothing had changed outside, Tengo zipped his jacket up to his neck, stuck his hands in his pockets, and walked out onto the main road. Ushikawa hurriedly put on his knit cap, wrapped the muffler around his neck, slipped on his shoes, and went out to follow Tengo. Tengo strolled slowly down the street and turned around to look behind him a few times, but Ushikawa was careful, and Tengo didn't see him. Tengo seemed to have something on his mind. Perhaps he was thinking about Fuka Eri being gone. He was apparently heading toward the station. Maybe he was going to take a train somewhere. That would make tailing him difficult. The station was well lit, and on a Saturday night there wouldn't be many passengers. Ushikawa would be extremely conspicuous. In that case, it would be smarter to give up. But Tengo wasn't heading toward the station. He walked for a while and then turned down a nearly deserted street and came to a halt in front of a bar named Mugiyatama. It was a bar for young people by the look of it. Tengo glanced at his watch to check the time, stood there pondering for a few seconds, then went inside. "Mugiyatama," Ushikawa thought. He shook his head. "What a stupid name for a bar." Ushikawa hid in the shadow of a telephone pole and checked out his surroundings. Tengo was probably going to have a couple of drinks there and a bite to eat, so it would take at least a half hour. Worst case scenario, Ushikawa would have to stay put for an hour. He looked around for a good place nearby to kill time while he watched the people going in and out of the bar. Unfortunately, though, there was just a milk distributor, a small Tenrikyo meeting hall, and a rice wholesaler, and all of them were closed.
Man, I never get a break, he thought.
The strong northwest wind blew the clouds swiftly by. The warmth of the daytime seemed like a dream now. Ushikawa wasn't relishing the idea of standing in the freezing cold for 30 minutes to an hour doing nothing.
Maybe I should give it up. Tango's just having a meal here. There's no need to go to all the trouble of shadowing him.
Ushikawa considered popping in to some place himself, having a hot meal, then going home. Tango would come back home before long. That was a very attractive choice. Ushikawa pictured himself in a cozy little restaurant, enjoying a piping hot bowl of oyakodon, rice topped with chicken and eggs. These last few days he hadn't eaten anything worth mentioning. Some hot sake would hit the spot, too. In this cold, one step outside and you'll sober up quick. But another scenario came to him. Tango might be meeting somebody at Mugiyatama. When Tango left his apartment, he went straight there, and he checked his watch just before he went in. Someone might be waiting for him inside, or might be on his way. If that was the case, Ushikawa had to know who this person was. His ears might freeze off, but he had to stand watch and see who went into the bar. He resigned himself to this, wiping the picture of oyakodon and hot sake from his mind. The person he's meeting might be Fukaeri, or Aomame. Ushikawa pulled himself together.
After all, perseverance is my strong point.
If there was a glimmer of hope, he clung to it desperately. The rain could pelt him, the wind could blow. He could be burned by the sun and beaten with a stick, but he would never let go. Once you let go, you never know when you'll get a hold of it again. He knew full well there were more painful things than this in the world, a thought that helped him endure his own suffering. He leaned against the wall, in the shadows of a telephone pole and a sign advertising the Japanese Communist Party, and kept a sharp watch over the front door of Mugiyatama. He wrapped the green muffler up to his nose and stuck his hands inside the pockets of his peacoat. Other than occasionally extracting a tissue from his pocket to blow his nose, he didn't move an inch. Announcements over the PA system at Koenji Station would filter over on the wind from time to time. Some pedestrians looked nervous when they saw Ushikawa huddled in the shadows and hurried past. Since it was dark, though, they couldn't make out his features. His stocky frame loomed in the shadows like some ominous ornament and sent people scurrying away in fright. What could Tango be drinking and eating in there? The more he thought about it, the hungrier and colder he got. But he couldn't help imagining it.
Anything's fine. Doesn't have to be hot sake or oyakodon. I just want to go someplace warm and have a regular meal. But if I can stand being out here in the cold, I can take anything.
Ushikawa had no choice. There was no other path for him to take than this one, freezing in the cold wind until Tango finished his meal. Ushikawa thought about his home in Churinkan and the dining table there. There must have been hot meals on that table every day, but he couldn't recall them.
What in the world did I eat back then?
It was like something out of antiquity. Long, long ago, a 15-minute walk from Churinkan Station on the Odakyu line. There had been a newly built house and a warm, inviting dinner table. Two little girls played piano, and a small pedigreed puppy scampered about the tiny garden and lawn. Tango came out of the bar 35 minutes later. Not bad. It could have been a lot worse, Ushikawa reassured himself. The 35 minutes had been terrible, but it was certainly better than an awful hour and a half. His body was chilled, but at least his ears hadn't frozen. While Tango was in the bar, there was no one going in or out of Mugiyatama who caught Ushikawa's attention. Just one couple went inside and no one came out. Tango must have just had a few drinks and a light meal. Keeping the same distance as before, Ushikawa followed behind him. Tango walked down the same street, most likely headed back to his apartment. But Tango turned off this street and headed down a road that Ushikawa had never been on before. It looked like Tango was not on his way home after all. Ushikawa was convinced that he was still lost in thought, maybe even more so than before. He didn't glance back this time. Ushikawa kept track of the scenery passing by, checking the street signs, trying to memorize the route so he could retrace it later on. Ushikawa wasn't familiar with this area, but from the increasing buzz of traffic, like the rushing of a river, he surmised they must be getting closer to the Ring Road. Before long, Tango picked up the pace, getting closer to his destination, perhaps.
Not bad. So this guy is heading somewhere. It was worth tailing him after all.
Tango quickly cut through a residential street. It was a Saturday night with a cold wind blowing, so everyone else was inside in front of the TV, enjoying a hot drink. The street was practically deserted. Ushikawa followed behind Tango, making sure to keep enough distance between them. Tango was an easy type of person to shadow. He was tall and big-boned and wouldn't get lost in a crowd. He just forged on ahead and didn't get sidetracked. He was always looking slightly down, thinking. He was essentially a straightforward, honest man, not the type to hide anything.
Totally different from me, Ushikawa thought.
Ushikawa's wife had also liked to hide things. No, it wasn't that she liked to hide things. She couldn't help it. Ask her what time it was, and she probably wouldn't tell you the correct time. Ushikawa wasn't like this. He only hid things when it was necessary, only when it pertained to work. If someone asked him the time and there was no reason for him to be dishonest, he would tell them and be nice about it. Not like his wife. She even lied about her age, shaving 4 years off. When they submitted the documents for their marriage license, he found out how old she really was, but pretended not to notice. Ushikawa couldn't fathom why she had to lie about something that was going to come out anyway. Who cared if his wife happened to be 7 years older? As they got even farther from the station, there were fewer people on the street. Eventually, Tango turned into a little park, a nothing little playground in one corner of a residential district. The park was deserted.
Of course it is, Ushikawa thought. Who feels like spending time in a playground on a cold, windy December night?
Tango passed under the cold light of a mercury vapor lamp and headed straight toward the slide. He stepped onto it and climbed to the top. Ushikawa hid behind a phone booth and kept an eye on Tango.
A slide?
Ushikawa frowned. Why does a grown man have to climb to the top of a slide on a freezing cold night like this? This wasn't near Tango's apartment. There must be some reason he would go out of his way to come here. It wasn't exactly the most appealing playground. It was cramped and shabby. In addition to the slide, there were two swings, a small jungle gym, and a sandbox. A single mercury vapor lamp that looked like it had illuminated the end of the world more than a few times. A single crude, leafless zelkova tree. A locked-up public toilet was the perfect canvas for graffiti. There was not a thing in this park to warm people's hearts or to stimulate the imagination. Perhaps on a bracing May afternoon there might be something, but on a windy December night, forget it. Was Tango meeting up with somebody here? Waiting for somebody to show? Ushikawa didn't think so. Tango didn't give any signs to indicate that he was looking for someone. When he entered the park, he ignored all the other equipment. The only thing on his mind seemed to be the slide.
Tango came here to climb up that slide.
Maybe he had always liked to sit on top of slides when he needed to think. Maybe the top of a slide in a park at night was the perfect place to think about the plot of the novel he was writing, or mathematical formulas. Maybe the darker it was, the colder the wind blew, the shabbier the park, the better he could think. What or how novelists or mathematicians thought was way beyond anything Ushikawa could imagine. His practical mind told him that he had to stay put, patiently keeping an eye on Tengo. His watch showed exactly 8 p.m. Tengo sat down on top of the slide, as if folding his large frame. He looked up at the sky. He moved his head back and forth, then settled on a single spot and gazed upward, his head still. Ushikawa recalled a sentimental old pop song by Kyu Sakamoto. It began, "Look up at the night sky, see the little stars." He didn't know how the rest of it went, and he really didn't care to know. Sentiment and a sense of justice were Ushikawa's two weakest areas. Up on top of the slide, was Tengo feeling sentimental as he gazed at the stars? Ushikawa tried looking up at the sky himself, but he couldn't see any stars. Koenji, Suginami Ward, Tokyo, was not the best place to observe the night sky. Neon signs and lights along the street dyed the whole sky a weird color. Some people, if they squinted hard, might be able to make out a few stars, but that would require extraordinary vision and concentration. On top of that, the clouds tonight were blowing hard across the sky. Still, Tengo sat motionless on top of the slide, his eyes on a fixed point in the sky. "What a pain in the butt this guy is," Ushikawa decided. What possible reason could there be to sit on a slide, gaze up at the sky, and ponder things on a windy winter night like this? Not that he had any right to criticize Tengo. Ushikawa had taken it upon himself, after all, to secretly observe Tengo and shadow him. Tengo was a free citizen and had every right to look at what he wanted, where he wanted, the whole year round. "Still, it's damn cold." He had needed to pee for some time, but had held it in. The public toilet was locked, though, and even in a deserted place like this, he couldn't very well just pee next to a phone booth. "Come on," he thought, stamping his feet. "Can't you just get up and leave already? You might be lost in thought, overtaken by sentiment, deep into your astronomical observations. But Tengo, you gotta be freezing too. Time to go back to your place and warm up, don't you think? Neither of us has anyone waiting for us, but it's still a hell of a lot better than hanging out here and freezing our rear ends off." Tengo didn't seem about to get up, though. He finally stopped gazing at the sky, and he turned his attention to the apartment building across the way. It was a new condo, 6 stories tall, with lights on in about half the windows. Tengo stared at the building. Ushikawa did the same, but found nothing that caught his attention. It was just an ordinary condo. It was not an exclusive building, but fairly high class, nonetheless. High-quality design, expensive tile, exterior. The entrance was beautiful and well-lit. It was a different animal entirely from the cheap, slated-to-be-torn-down place that Tengo called home. As he gazed up at the condo, was Tengo wishing he could live in a place like that? Ushikawa didn't think so. As far as Ushikawa knew, Tengo wasn't the type to care about where he lived, just like he didn't care much about clothes. Most likely he was happy with his shabby apartment. A roof over your head and a place to keep out of the cold, that was enough for him. Whatever was running through his head up there on the slide must be something else. After Tengo had looked at all the windows in the condo, he turned his gaze once more to the sky. Ushikawa followed suit. From where he was hidden, the branches of the Zelkova tree, the electric lines, and the other buildings got in the way. He could only see half the sky. What particular point in the sky Tengo was looking at wasn't at all clear. Countless clouds ceaselessly scudded across the sky like some overwhelming army bearing down on them. Eventually, Tengo stood up and silently climbed down from the slide, like a pilot having just landed after a rough solo flight at night. He cut across the playground and left. Ushikawa hesitated, then decided not to follow him. Most likely, Tango was on his way back to his place. Plus, Ushikawa had to pee like crazy. After he saw Tango disappear, he went into the playground, hustled behind the public toilet, and in the darkness, where no one could see him, he peed into a bush. His bladder was ready to burst. He finally finished peeing, the operation taking as long as it would take a long freight train to cross a bridge, zipped up his pants, shut his eyes, and gave a deep sigh of relief. His watch showed 8:17. Tango had been on top of the slide for about 15 minutes. Ushikawa checked again that Tango wasn't around and headed toward the slide. He clambered up the ladder with his short, bandy legs, sat down on the very top of the freezing slide, and looked up. What could he have been staring at so intently? Ushikawa had pretty good eyesight. Astigmatism made his eyes a bit out of balance, but generally he could get by every day without glasses. Still, no matter how hard he looked, he couldn't make out a single star. What caught his attention instead was the large moon in the sky, about two-thirds full. Its dark, bruised exterior was clearly exposed between the clouds, your typical winter moon, cold, pale, full of ancient mysteries and inklings. Unblinking like the eyes of the dead, it hung there, silent, in the sky. Ushikawa gulped. For a while he forgot to breathe. Through a break in the clouds, there was another moon, a little way apart from the first one. This was much smaller than the original moon, slightly warped in shape and green, like it had moss growing on it. But it was undoubtedly a moon. No star was that big, and it couldn't be a satellite. Yet there it was, pasted onto the night sky. Ushikawa shut his eyes, then a few seconds later opened them again. This must be an illusion. That kind of thing can't be there. But no matter how many times he opened and closed his eyes, the little moon was still in the sky. Passing clouds hit it occasionally, but once they passed by, there it was, in the same exact spot. This is what Tango was looking at. Tango Kuwana had come to this playground to see this scene, or perhaps to check that it still existed. He has known for some time that there are two moons, no doubt about it. He didn't look at all surprised to see it. On top of the slide, Ushikawa sighed deeply. What kind of crazy world is this? He asked himself. What sort of world have I gotten myself into? But no answer came. Swept by countless clouds racing by, the two moons, one big, one small, hung in the sky like a riddle. There's one thing I can say for sure, he decided. This isn't the world I came from. The Earth, I know, has only one moon. That is an undeniable fact, and now it has increased to two. Ushikawa began to have a sense of deja vu. I've seen the same thing before somewhere, he thought. He focused, desperately searching his memory. He frowned, grit his teeth, dredging the dark sea bottom of his mind, and it finally hit him. Air chrysalis. He looked around, but all he saw was the same world as always. White lace curtains were drawn in windows in the condo across the street. Peaceful lights on behind them. Nothing out of the ordinary. Only the number of moons was different. He carefully climbed down from the slide and hurriedly left the playground as if running from the eyes of the moons. Am I going nuts? He wondered. No, that can't be it. I'm not going crazy. My mind is like a brand new steel nail. Hard, sober, straight. Hammered at just the right angle into the core of reality. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm completely sane. It's the world around me that's gone crazy, and I have to find out why.
Chapter 20 Amame. One aspect of my transformation, On Sunday, the wind had died down. It was a warm, calm day, totally different from the night before. People took off their heavy coats and enjoyed the sunshine. Almama, however, did not enjoy the nice weather. She spent the day as always, shut away in her room, the curtains closed. As she listened to Janáček's Sinfonietta, the sound down low, she stretched and then turned to her exercise machine to do some resistance training. She was gradually adding routines to her training workout, and it now took nearly 2 hours to complete. Afterwards, she cooked, cleaned the apartment, and lay on the sofa to read In Search of Lost Time. She had finally begun Volume 3, The Guermont Way. She tried her best to keep busy. She only watched TV twice a day, the NHK news broadcasts at noon and 7 p.m. As always, nothing big was going on. No, actually lots of big events were happening in the world. People all around the world had lost their lives, many of them in tragic ways. Train wrecks, ferry boats sinking, plane crashes. A civil war went on with no end in sight, an assassination, a terrible ethnic massacre. Weather shifts had brought on drought, floods, famine. Al-Mame deeply sympathized with the people caught up in these tragedies and disasters. But even so, not a single thing had occurred that had a direct bearing on her. Neighborhood children were playing in the playground across the street, shouting something. She could hear the crows gathered on the roof, calling out the latest gossip. The air had that early winter city smell. It suddenly hit her that ever since she had been living in this condo, she had never once felt any sexual desire. Not once had she felt like having sex. She hadn't even masturbated. Maybe it was due to her pregnancy and her body's hormonal changes. Still, Almame was relieved. This wasn't exactly the place to find a sexual outlet, should she decide she had to sleep with someone. She was happy, too, to not have any more periods. Her periods had never been heavy, but still she felt as if she had set down a load she had been carrying forever. It was one less thing to have to think about. In the 3 months that she had been here, her hair had grown long. In September, it had barely touched her shoulders, but now it was down to her shoulder blades. When she was a child, her mother had always trimmed it short, and from junior high onward, because sports had been her life, she had never let it grow out. It felt a bit too long now, but she couldn't very well cut it herself. She trimmed her bangs, but that was all. She kept her hair up during the day and let it down at night. And then, while listening to music, she brushed it 100 strokes, something you can only do if you have plenty of time on your hands. Normally, she wore almost no makeup, and now especially there was no need for it. But she wanted to keep a set daily routine as much as she could, so she made sure to take good care of her skin. She massaged her skin with creams and lotions, put on a face mask before bedtime. She was basically a very healthy person, and just a little extra care was all it took for her skin to be beautiful and lustrous. Or maybe this, too, was a byproduct of being pregnant. She had heard that pregnant women had beautiful skin. Either way, when she sat at her mirror, let down her hair, and examined her face, she did feel she looked prettier than ever before. Or at least she was taking on the composure of a mature woman. Probably. Almama had never once felt beautiful. No one had ever told her that she was. Her mother treated her like she was an ugly child. "If only you were prettier," her mother always said. Meaning if she were prettier, a cuter child, they could recruit more converts. So Almama had always avoided looking at herself in mirrors. When she absolutely had to, she quickly, efficiently, checked out her reflection. Tamaki Otsuka had told her she liked her features. "Not bad at all," she had said. "They are actually very nice. You should have more confidence." That had made Almame happy. She was just entering puberty, and her friend's warm words calmed her. "Maybe I'm not as ugly as my mother said I was," she began to think. But even Tamaki had never called her beautiful. Now, however, for the first time in her life, Amama saw something beautiful in her face. She was able to sit in front of the mirror longer than ever before and examine her face more thoroughly. She wasn't being narcissistic. She inspected her face from a number of angles, as if it were somebody else's. Had she really become beautiful? Or was it her way of appreciating everything that had changed, not her face itself? Ah, Mama couldn't decide. Occasionally, she would put on a big frown in the mirror. Her frowning face looked the same as it always had. The muscles in her face stretched in all directions, her features unraveled, each distinct from the other. All possible emotions in the world gushed out from her face. It was neither beautiful nor ugly. From one angle, she looked demonic. From a different angle, comic. And from yet another angle, her face was a chaotic jumble. When she stopped frowning, her facial muscles gradually relaxed, like ripples vanishing on the surface of water, and her usual features returned. And then Ah Mama discovered a new, slightly different version of herself. "You should smile more naturally," Tamaki had often told her. "Your features are gentle when you smile, so it's a shame that you don't do so more often." But Ah Mama could never smile easily or casually in front of people. When she forced it, she ended up with a tight sneer, which made others even more tense and uncomfortable. Tamaki was different. She had a natural, cheerful smile. People meeting her for the first time immediately felt friendly toward her. In the end, though, disappointment and despair drove Tamaki to take her own life, leaving Ah Mama, who couldn't manage a decent smile, behind. It was a quiet Sunday. The warm sunshine had led many people to the playground across the road. Parents stood around, their children playing in the sandbox or on the swings. Some kids were playing on the slide. Elderly people sat on the benches, intently watching the children at play. Ah Mama went out on her balcony, sat on her garden chair, and half-heartedly watched through a gap in the screen. It was a peaceful scene. Time was marching on in the world. Nobody there was under threat of death. Nobody there was on the trail of a killer. Nobody there had a fully loaded 9mm automatic pistol wrapped in tights in her dresser drawer. "Will I ever be able to participate in that quiet, normal world again?" Ah Mama asked herself. "Will there ever come a day when I can lead this little one by the hand, go to the park, and let it play on the swings, on the slides, lead my daily life without thinking about who I will kill next or who will kill me? Is that possible in this 1Q84 world? Or is it only possible in some other world? And most important of all, will Tengo be beside me?" Ah Mama stopped looking at the park and went back inside. She closed the sliding glass door and shut the curtains. She couldn't hear the children's voices now, and a sadness tugged at her. She was cut off from everything, stuck in a place that was locked from the inside. "I'll stop watching the playground during the day. Tengo won't come in the daytime." What he was looking for was a clear view of the two moons. After she had a simple dinner and washed the dishes, Ah Mama dressed warmly and went out on the balcony once more. She laid the blanket on her lap and sank back in the chair. It was a windless night. The kind of clouds that watercolor artists like lingered faintly in the sky, a test of the artist's delicate brushstrokes. The larger moon, which was not blocked by the clouds, was two-thirds full and shone bright, distinct light down on the earth below. At this time of evening, from where she sat, Ah Mama couldn't see the second smaller moon. It was just behind a building, but Amame knew it was there. She could feel its presence. No doubt it would soon appear before her. Ever since she had gone into hiding, she had been able to intentionally shut thoughts out of her mind, especially when she was on the balcony like this, gazing at the playground. She could make her mind a complete blank. She kept her eyes focused on the playground, especially on the slide, but she wasn't thinking of anything. No, her mind might have been thinking of something, but this was mostly below the surface. What her mind was doing below the surface, she had no idea. At regular intervals, something would float up, like sea turtles and porpoises poking their faces through the surface of the water to breathe. When that happened, she knew that indeed she had been thinking of something up till then. Then her consciousness, lungs full of fresh oxygen, sank back below the surface. It was gone again, and Al-Mama no longer thought of anything. She was a surveillance device, wrapped in a soft cocoon, her gaze absorbed in the slide. She was seeing the park, but at the same time she was seeing nothing. If anything new came across her line of vision, her mind would react immediately. But right now nothing new was happening. There was no wind. The dark branches of the Zelkova tree stuck out, unmoving, like sharp probes pointed toward the sky. The whole world was still. She looked at her watch. It was after 8. Today might end as always, with nothing out of the ordinary. A Sunday night, as quiet as could be. The world stopped being still at exactly 8:23. She suddenly noticed a man on top of the slide. He sat down and looked up at one part of the sky. Almama's heart shrunk to the size of a child's fist and stayed that size so long she was afraid it would never start pumping again. But it just as quickly swelled up to normal size and started beating again. With a dull sound, it began furiously pumping fresh blood throughout her body. Almama's mind quickly broke through to the surface of the water, shook itself, and stood by, ready to take action. "It's Tengo," she thought instinctively. But once her vision cleared, she knew it wasn't him. The man sitting there was short, like a child, with a large square head wearing a knit hat. The knit hat was stretched out oddly because of the shape of his head. He had a green muffler wrapped around his neck and wore a navy blue coat. The muffler was too long, and the buttons on his coat were strained around his stomach, ready to pop. Amame knew this was the child she had seen last night coming out of the park. But this was no child. He was more near middle age. He was short and stocky, with short limbs, and his head was abnormally large and misshapen. Almame remembered what Tomato had said about the man with the head as large as a Fukusuke good luck doll, the one they had nicknamed Bobblehead. The person who had been loitering around outside the Azabu Willow House, checking out the safe house. This man on top of the slide perfectly fit the description Tomato had given her last night. That weird man hadn't given up on his investigation, and now he had crept up on her. "I have to get the pistol. Why, of all nights did I leave it back in the bedroom?" Almama took a deep breath, let the chaos of her heart settle, and her nerves calm down. "I mustn't panic. There's no need for the pistol at this point." The man wasn't, after all, watching her building. Seated at the top of the slide, he was staring at the sky like Tengo had done, at the very same spot. And he seemed lost in thought. He didn't move a muscle for the longest time, like he had forgotten how to move. He didn't pay any attention to the direction of her room. This confused Amame. "What's going on? This man came here searching for me. He's probably a member of Sakigake. No doubt at all, he's a skilled pursuer. I mean, he was able to follow the trail all the way from the Azabu mansion to here. For all that, there he is now, defenseless, exposed, staring vacantly at the night sky. Almama stealthily rose to her feet, slid open the glass door crack, slipped inside, and sat down in front of the phone. With trembling hands, she began dialing Tamaru's number. She had to report this to him, that she could see Bobblehead from where she was, on top of a slide in a playground across the street. Tamaru would decide what to do, and would no doubt deftly handle the situation. But after punching in the first four numbers, she stopped. The receiver clutched in her hand and bit her lip. It's too soon, Almama thought. There are still too many things we don't know about this man. If Tamaru simply sees him as a risk factor and takes care of him, all those things we don't know about him will remain unknown. Come to think of it, the man is doing exactly what Tengo did the other day. The same slide, the same pose, the same part of the sky, as if he's retracing Tengo's movements. He must be seeing the two moons as well. Almama understood this. Maybe this man and Tengo are linked in some way. And maybe this man hasn't noticed yet that I'm hiding out in an apartment in this building, which is why he's sitting there defenseless, his back to me. The more she thought about it, the more persuasive she found this theory. If that's true, then, following the man might lead me right to Tengo. Instead of searching me out, this guy can serve as my guide. The thought made her heart contract even more and then start to pound. She laid down the phone. I'll tell Tamaru about this later, she decided. There's something I have to do first. Something risky, because it involves the pursued following the pursuer. And this man is no doubt a pro. But even so, I can't let this golden opportunity slip by. This may be my last chance. And from the way he looks, he seems to be in a bit of a daze. At least for the moment. She hurried into the bedroom, opened the dresser drawer, and took out the Heckler & Koch semi-automatic. She flicked off the safety, racked around into the chamber, and reset it. She stuffed the pistol into the back of her jeans and went out to the balcony again. Bobblehead was still there, staring at the sky. His misshapen head was perfectly still. He seemed totally captivated by what he was seeing in the sky. Almama knew how he felt. That was most definitely a captivating sight. Almama went back inside and put on a down jacket and a baseball cap, and a pair of non-prescription glasses with a simple black frame, enough to give her face a different appearance. She wound a gray muffler around her neck and put her wallet and apartment key in her pocket. She ran down the stairs and went out of the building. The soles of her sneakers were silent as she stepped out on the asphalt. It had been so long since she had felt hard, steady ground beneath her feet, and the feeling encouraged her. As she walked down the road, she checked that Bobblehead was still in the same place. The temperature had dropped significantly after the sun had set, but there was still no wind. She actually found the cold pleasant. Her breath white, Almama walked as silently as she could past the entrance to the park. Bobblehead showed no sign that he had noticed her. His gaze was fixed straight up from the slide, on the sky. From where she was, Almama couldn't see them, but she knew that at the end of his gaze, there were two moons, one large, one small. No doubt they were snuggled up close to each other in the freezing, cloudless sky. She passed by the park, and when she got to the next corner, she turned and retraced her steps. She hid in the shadows and watched the man on the slide. The pistol against her back was as hard and cold as death, and the feeling soothed her. She waited 5 minutes. Bobblehead slowly got to his feet, brushed off his coat,